This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, September 13th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. And our State House correspondent Katie Lannon will be speaking with CAI's Gilda Geist. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. New offshore wind contracts have been awarded in Massachusetts and some in Rhode Island, too. They're part of New England's first regional bidding process for new wind farms. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us with the wind news and some election news as well. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Last week on the news roundup, we were expecting the wind contracts to be announced at any moment. Governor Healey's office did make that announcement a little bit later in the day last Friday. Give us the top line here. Which wind projects were chosen and where are they going to be?
Sure. So these projects that got selected last Friday are New England Wind 1, South Coast Wind, and Vineyard Wind 2. All of them are going to be in the wind area south of Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. The closest turbines will be about 20 to 30 miles offshore, depending on the project. Vineyard Wind, of course, is two, Vineyard Wind 2, because Vineyard Wind 1 is already under construction down there. New England Wind 1 has that number because it's part of a two-part project. And part two did not get selected here and was actually the only bid into Massachusetts that did not get selected. There was another one in just Rhode Island and Connecticut that also has not been selected yet. But in this selection, Massachusetts utilities agreed to buy almost 2,700 megawatts of power from these wind farms, which is the largest purchase of offshore wind in New England. And Governor Healey says it will meet about 20% of the state's power demand. So a pretty decent chunk.
That's a big wind package. We know that this was part of a tri-state effort to put contracts out for wind power. What about Rhode Island and even Connecticut? What are they buying?
Yes. So Rhode Island is buying part of the power from South Coast Wind. The states were able to split it up this way. So South Coast Wind total is over 1,200 megawatts, and Rhode Island is buying 200 of that total. Massachusetts is buying the rest. Massachusetts did not have to take the full amount for the others as well, as I talked about. So Vineyard Wind 2, Massachusetts is only taking 800 and leaving another 400 megawatts on the table. You mentioned Connecticut. Connecticut has yet to announce anything, even though they were part of this tri-state procurement process. So people are wondering what's going to happen there. For Vineyard Wind 2 there, which is now only part of it, has been taken, but its project financials are based on that full 1,200 megawatts. So then the question in a lot of people's minds is, what is the developer's response to that? Essentially, they didn't sell the whole project. The policy magazine Commonwealth Beacon up in Boston suggested that the future of Vineyard Wind could be in doubt because of that. For example, if Connecticut doesn't then go ahead and buy the remaining 400 megawatts. But Vineyard Wind 2 is early in the permitting. They have years, a couple of years at least, to go. So they will have other opportunities to get the rest of that contract purchased, whether it's from Connecticut or somewhere else. I mean, Massachusetts is planning to do another bid next year, so it could be there as well.
All right, there's a lot of numbers there, megawatts and things of like that. But the landside economic benefits of these projects have been a big part of the discussion. We know the wind developers have each made different commitments about where to base their work and what kinds of job training they'll be supporting. Can you just give us a brief rundown of some of what will be happening locally?
Right. So the developers do commonly give some kind of financial support for job training. For example, we know that some training is already happening at Mass Maritime and at Bristol Community College. And South Coast Wind, for example, is planning to put more money toward training at those schools. And each project has a different plan for where to base their operations, where to base their turbine construction staging, and then their long-term maintenance work. All three of the projects will be doing their operations and maintenance out of New Bedford, which is great for the city. And South Coast Wind is also staging installation out of New Bedford. The others are doing their installation from the new terminal in Salem. But that facility just had their ceremonial groundbreaking last month. So full use of Salem is a little ways off, but definitely a lot in here for the South Coast in terms of the economic activity.
This is a huge new industry being launched right here. Give us a quick take on some of the local reaction to these new wind contracts. We've done a lot of reporting about support and opposition. What did you hear on the day that the new wind farms were announced?
I caught up with New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell. He said he was very pleased to see this. He said he feels like these awards reflect the values he's been pushing for, which are, you know, both fighting climate change and also, again, bringing those economic opportunities for greater New Bedford. So he was happy.
We don't know specifically what the wind power in these new contracts will cost yet. Their financial information is redacted from the public version of the bids until the contracts are negotiated. But something interesting did happen this week regarding the wind farm financials. Explain what this was about.
Yes. So some officials from the Healey administration held a press briefing after the big announcement. And one of them said in that briefing, it was a surprise, I think, to most or all of us on the call, what was that none of these bids that were selected in Massachusetts chose to index their pricing to inflation. Now, remember, the point of that, it was that the ability to tie prices to inflation and let them increase as costs increased was something that was supposed to be new in this round of bidding. It was new, but it was supposed to fix the problem that led to several wind farms canceling their contracts in the last couple of years. And then as a result, they had to pay, you know, tens of millions of dollars in fees to cancel, penalties to cancel those contracts, and the state didn't get the wind. So they had the chance to use inflation, to index to inflation this time around. They didn't. It's kind of curious that they didn't. I don't know. Perhaps they thought it would be a competitive edge in the bidding. I don't know. But I am interested to see what else they might have done instead in order to protect themselves financially from, you know, cost increases like that.
This is such a complicated process here. The developers, as I understand, are going to be negotiating their contracts. Now they've been awarded these contracts, but now they have to negotiate them. Explain what's next in the process.
Right. So they've like won the right to have the contract, but they still have to negotiate it and get, you know, get all the legal details and the financial commitments nailed down. And that negotiation happens with the utility companies who are buying the power. Right. That's Eversource, National Grid, and one other one called Unitil, which is a smaller one. They have a deadline to negotiate by November 8th. And then after that, they need to submit those contracts to the State Department of Public Utilities in mid-December. That agency, the DPU, puts its stamp of approval on those contracts, and then they're done. So that's it for this round. As I said, the state is planning to go out to bid again next year. So the state officials are going to be moving on to planning that, I think. And this was interesting, too, on that press call. A Rhode Island official who was on the call said he anticipates the states will work together again probably next year, at least those two states. We still don't know about Connecticut.
Let's move on now to some election news that's still happening as we speak. A recount is taking place in a local Republican primary for the state Senate. This is in the Plymouth and Barnstable district, which includes four towns on the Upper Cape. I guess start by telling us why there is this recount.
Yes. Well, first of all, just to name the towns here for the Cape, they're Bourne, Falmouth, Mashpee, and Sandwich. And then it also has towns in Plymouth County. But the as far as the reason for the recount, what's going on is that one of the two candidates in this Republican primary, Carrie McRae, asked for the recount. She had issued a statement the day after the election saying that she was not happy with the way Plymouth counted their early and mail-in ballots late at night. Now, I don't have Plymouth's side of that story, and McRae did not make any specific allegation of wrongdoing, but nevertheless, she requested this recount. It's really not unusual in a close race for the person on the losing end of that to request a recount. I mean, why not, right? We have a Senate seat on the line. So, but the margin here was 45 votes between her and her opponent, who is a state representative now, Matthew Muratori. In a race this size, to have 45 votes switch would be kind of a lot. So really, Muratori is most likely going to be pulling through with the win here for the Republican primary for state Senate.
Now, you went out to one of the recount sites this week. They were doing the recount in Sandwich this week. Give us a sense of what the scene is like when they're doing this.
Sure, this is like local government at its finest, really, right? It was in a big meeting room at the old Sandwich Town Hall. It's one of those antique meeting halls with a stage at one end. It's beautiful. And they had seven tables set up there. Each table had election workers and at least one observer from one of the campaigns. Most of the tables had two, if they had enough volunteers. The town clerk for Sandwich, Taylor White, was there giving instructions to everyone and really overseeing the whole thing. So the ballots are grouped in manila envelopes, and each table gets an envelope from the clerk to count. First, they just count the number of ballots so they know exactly how many in each envelope they have to account for. They pass them all back. That gets recorded. They receive the envelopes again, and then they take the ballots out. They examine each one, make sure they agree on the vote that was cast, record those on a tally sheet. And at the front of the room was the Board of Registrars, and they were tallying all the counts from the tables to finally come up with the final count.
So, with the big question, how did it turn out? Did the recount match the original count?
Well, Carrie McRae did get one additional vote. The town clerk said it was a ballot that had been previously counted as blank. When the recounters looked at it, they determined it was for Carrie McRae.
Tell us a little bit more about the significance of this particular primary. We know that the winner will be vying for this open state Senate seat.
Right. So this is the seat where Senator Susan Moran is leaving. She decided she's not running for Senate, although she is running for office. She is running for clerk of courts in Barnstable County. So as you said, it's an open seat. And this seat has flipped parties over the years. It's been Democratic most recently with Senator Moran. But before that, Senator Vinnie DiMaceo was in this seat as a Republican. And this is an interesting race because whoever wins this Republican primary will be facing State Representative Dylan Fernandez in November for the Senate seat. As we said, Muratori is likely to be the Republican primary winner, which means that we will have two sitting state reps pitted against one another to move into this Senate seat. So if you ask me, that could make for a very intense race, right? Both of these candidates have been elected before. Their voters, they have their voter base, and they're going to be going against one another. So there's an interesting element of geography, I think. Fernandez is from Falmouth, same as Senator Moran, and Senator Moran has endorsed him. But Representative Muratori is from Plymouth, which is the largest population center in the district. So that could work in his favor.
And this district spans from off Cape onto Cape and the Upper Cape. It is, as you point out, it's an interesting geographically designated district. This isn't the only election in our region where we've seen a very interesting Republican primary.
That's true. There was an upset in the GOP primary in the second Plymouth House district. That is the district for state rep there that includes Wareham and also Carver and part of Middleborough. And a Republican state rep who's been in that seat for more than 2 decades is Susan Williams Gifford. You may know the name. And she was unseated in the primary by John Gaske. Gaske's social media postings really sought to position him as more conservative than Gifford on a number of things, notably migration. A lot of his posts were about migration. He's talked about abortion and other issues. clearly primary voters in the Republican primary liked that message and supported him. But I would say what's perhaps most notable here, too, is that there is no Democrat running in this seat in, you know, stereotypically Democratic Massachusetts. But with Susan Williams Gifford, that long-term incumbent in the seat, maybe that's why no Republican decided to throw, I mean, sorry, no Democrat decided to run their, throw their hat into the ring. So now, from that primary, we have Mr. Gaskey. John Gaskey essentially is going to be the new state rep for Wareham and the rest of that district.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes bringing us from wind farms to local elections. Jeanette, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with CAI's Eve Zukoff, and a little later, it will be Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. The Massachusetts Army National Guard and the Environmental Protection Agency will sit down this fall in an attempt to address their disagreements over the risks of a proposed machine gun range on Joint Base Cape Cod. CAI's Eve Zukoff has details about the unusual meeting, and she joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
I can't remember ever hearing about a meeting like this. Explain what we know about what's supposed to happen at this meeting.
Yes. Okay. So this meeting on October 30th will be attended by a group of experts who can offer insights into the technical and scientific issues surrounding the range's potential impacts. So their expertise will be in groundwater hydrology, geochemistry, aquifer monitoring, toxicology, facilities construction. And they're being called in because you'll remember the EPA found in their draft report that the range could contaminate drinking water, and they put that draft out a year and a half ago. Since then, the Guard has denied that contamination could happen, so the EPA and Guard have just been at odds with each other, and now this meeting next month has been called, we're not entirely sure by who, but it will be facilitated by this outside neutral group, the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Math.
Talk a little bit about this idea of having a neutral facilitator. Why would that be needed here?
Well, I think there are two answers. First of all, the relationship between the Guard and the EPA has broken down. I mean, we've seen emails sent by Guard officials that show the Guard accusing the EPA of acting in bad faith, having improper relationships with range anti-range advocates. And ultimately, the Guard fought to get the EPA fully cut out of the range process altogether. Okay, and the second reason that this facilitator might be needed here has to do with the science. The Guard disagrees with conclusions in the EPA's draft report about the aquifer. Like, I'll give you an example. Last May 2023, the Guard said the EPA's own studies have found that chemical contaminants in ammunition that would be used in the proposed range, like copper, antimony, nitroglycerin, do not transport to the water table. But the EPA described the Guard's copper study as inconclusive, missing samples based on inappropriate composition of the experimental solutions, and then kind of seeing that the two are at an impasse, a Guard official said at the time, look, we do acknowledge the EPA has had some uncertainty, that's the word they used, with our results, and we kindly ask for the opportunity to re-examine collaboratively. This meeting coming up next month appears to be that effort.
And just to backfill here for anyone who hasn't been following this, this is about this machine gun range that the Army National Guard is proposing to build over the aquifer, which provides fresh drinking water to much of the Upper Cape. And
yes,
the real concern here is that if anything goes wrong and it contaminates the aquifer, then we have a really much bigger problem, which is what the EPA was pointing to in their draft report.
Exactly.
So the idea here with this meeting coming up that's scheduled for October 30th between the EPA, these federal environmental folks, and the Massachusetts Army National Guard, the idea here is to build consensus? Is that where we're going?
No, not necessarily. It's up to the EPA to decide what their report says. That's what officials have told us. They do not need to come to a consensus with the Guard, but this will be an opportunity rather to hear from experts about, you know, specific potential contaminants and contaminant pathways that could impact the aquifer from the range, and other relevant data will be brought to the fore too. And EPA officials said that they are like, open. They told us that further study could help fill in the gaps in the scientific analysis conducted so far, you know, and this information is needed to allow all parties to make sound decisions about whether the project should proceed. And look, Steve, I'll tell you, the stakes here are really high. EPA officials said that the meeting is expected to help the EPA finalize that draft report from a year and a half ago that's so critical here. And the next draft could offer a negative view of the range once again, or it could present a safer picture. And it is expected to hold sway with the state officials who really could approve or deny the range.
It's such an interesting process here that we're kind of all on the outside of the very fact that the EPA has put together this draft report, released a draft version of it, and for a year and a half has kind of just sat on it. And everybody's been wondering, you know, why they're just, if they've reached these conclusions, why it takes them so long to finalize it, if those are still the conclusions. I know you've reached out to the GARD, the EPA, and the Academy of Science, this neutral facilitator, asking for more information about this meeting next month. You haven't received many answers, and you and I have talked about some of the unanswered questions around this. I think they're helpful to hear. Can you just walk us through them?
Yeah, I think they are, because I want folks to know that we are asking the questions. We don't have all the information, but I hope it gives a window into kind of what people should be listening for, right? So one of my big questions is, why is this meeting happening now? We keep saying it a year and a half ago. I mean, I'm wondering, have the EPA and GARD officials not been trying to bridge the gap between the scientific and technical issues up until this point? Also, what's the ultimate goal of this forum as it relates to the release of the final EPA report? I want to know, you know, how this meeting will actually function. Will it be kind of a debate? Will it be more of a mediation? How are the experts there going to be chosen? Everyone has a dog in every fight. I mean, that's how I see things as a reporter. And I also want to know, and this is really important here, why will this meeting be closed to the public? We don't know if at the end of October 30th, we will have any sense of where it landed. That's my job to figure out if I can get a sense. But I think that in a project where accusations of non-transparency have been lobbied and kind of by everybody, I don't understand why it's not a public meeting.
All right. I want to pivot to kind of another angle on this same story, because this meeting was announced just 24 hours after you reported that the Association to Preserve Cape Cod is taking the Army National Guard to court around the machine gun range here. What's the legal complaint?
Sure. So the Association to Preserve Cape Cod has filed a complaint with Suffolk Superior Court, saying that the Guard has ignored 9 Freedom of Information Act requests that seek information about why the Guard has repeatedly sought contractor bids for a scaled-back version of the range, while at the same time, the Guard has not, of course, received the critical state approval for the project. So APCC is in court over one of the FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests in particular, but pointing to a larger pattern of non-compliance. They say that the Guard has been acting in bad faith to prevent the release of information. Of course, we are just talking about APCC's opinion. We can talk more about how the Guard responds to.
And the Guard all along has said that they need this range to train soldiers on these weapons, these long-distance sort of firing machine gun weapons that right now they have to go up to Vermont to train or some other distant locations. But now they've kind of scaled back the range that they're even asking for, so those weapons are likely not going to be able to be fired here anyway. And yet they're still pushing on this, which is their right. And there's a sense of urgency around, well, even around the APCC's court case here, which is asking to see these documents. You know, there's a timeline that they're working against.
Yes. So APCC is concerned that right now there are 17 days left for the Army National Guard to take the funds that they do have in the bank that were awarded to them by Congress to build this range and actually award a contract. If that 17 days, runs out, the Guard has no more money. They have nothing lined up because members of our congressional delegation stripped more funding for this range out of the next national defense bills. So in this 17 days, if they can get a contract awarded for this scaled down range, APCC is concerned that they will eventually move ahead, build this scaled-down range, and then say later, you know, guys, we actually really want to keep building. This range doesn't quite do enough. It just sets the table for the Guard, in the APCC's opinion, to bulldoze their way through this process. So it's this critical 17-day point where if they get the funds, in the APCC's opinion, they will start the process of doing something that's bad for the environment. Or if the 17 days runs out, you know, and a contract is not awarded, APCC feels safer about the environment in this case.
So in a minute here, today the judge will hear the Guard's argument and potentially make a decision about whether to make the military. The judge is going to hear the APCC argument and make this decision about whether to make the Guard turn over their emails and records. What is the Guard saying in all of this?
Yeah, at 2 p.m., both APCC and the Guard are expected to go to court. We reached out to the Guard earlier this week. Officially, they told us no comment when we asked about their opinion on this complaint. We were hoping, and I'm still hoping as of this morning, the Guard should file a response to the complaint before they actually are in court today. We don't know. That should happen. I haven't seen it yet. I'll be keeping my eye out for that. But yeah, I mean, as of today, they are expected to be in court, and maybe we'll get a better sense after 2 p.m.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
A new kind of legal court has come to Martha's Vineyard. It's aimed at helping people who are struggling with addiction issues. Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette is here with a story. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
Ethan, this is called Recovery Court. Explain what the idea is behind it.
Yeah, so this is a new court that's set up here in Edgartown. And the idea is, you know, courts deal with criminality a lot of times, and often charges kind of stem from substance abuse disorder or other underlying kind of addiction issues. And this new court is trying to get at the underlying issues instead of just kind of tagging people with sentences for charges.
So what does that mean practically? How is this operating?
Yeah, so if you are in the criminal justice system here on the island and you get a conviction or there's a plea deal, there is a new option here with the recovery court that you can now go through. You enter this program, and it kind of is a court-mandated kind of recovery program. So that's kind of tailored to every person who goes into it. For some people, it's, you know, kind of inpatient, going to a treatment facility, detox. For other people, it's kind of counseling. It can kind of really run the gamut. And then basically you have to report to court every week. It's an 18-month program. And basically they kind of just keep checking in on you to make sure that you're kind of hitting the goals.
And there's a number of different services that are sort of packaged along with this, and agencies who are participating in this. It's the legal system, but it's also support services.
Yeah, no, there's Island Healthcare, Martha's Vineyard Community Services, Gosnold's, for folks and families will know that one. So it's the probation department is really kind of the backbone of this whole thing. But I talked to one lawyer, and he said, you know, yes, we're in a courtroom. You kind of have a lot of the same players, but it's much more kind of informal. It's very conversational. They're checking in on kind of how you're doing every week. He said, you know, I'm there, but my tie's untied.
I'm also impressed by how individualized this process seems to be. They said they're kind of... Each case is its own case, right? It's not like a system that they're inputting somebody into here.
Yeah, it's highly individualized. I mean, right now it's very small. There's only 5 people in the program. They imagine they can get it to around maybe 10 people as it gets going here. But it is. I mean, you're screened by all these different agencies, and they kind of go through you to find a program that's tailored to you.
Can you tell us a little bit about the backstory here? The recovery court idea is not, it's new on the Vineyard right now, but it's not new as an idea.
No, there's, I believe there's like 28 to 32 of them around the state. There's one in Falmouth, I believe. I think there's one in Barnstable. So yeah, I mean, it's something that's kind of all around the state. We had someone working in ours who worked at the one in Charlestown, up by Boston. Yeah, it's something that's definitely established, and people kind of saw a need here. We have the I th- we outpace the binge drinking rate for the state and the U.S. We have one of the highest rates of alcohol deaths related to driving. Yeah, so it's definitely something that's not new, but it's finally kind of made its way out here.
And another one of the components here is that folks who make their way through this recovery court process, it's kind of a graduated process, and you graduate out, and then you're also expected to be part of the process going forward, or oftentimes people stick around and continue to support the program. Is that right?
Yeah, no, it's not like a requirement that you have to, but in talking with the woman who is running it here, who used to work out of Suffolk Superior Court, she said, you know, a lot of times people who go through this process then want to help other people who are entering it. So you get kind of this informal support system around kind of what's already a pretty robust and individualized program. And they just want to kind of, you know, if they it works for them, so they want to see it help other people.
That is Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette talking about the recovery court program that started up on Martha's Vineyard. Ethan, thanks so much.
Yep. Take care, Steve.
South Orleans has a new traffic rotary with a handsome new sculpture at the center. But the rotary, if you haven't heard, has recently developed an unappealing problem. Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here to explain what's going on. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Steve.
I did my best to set you up here, but this story is a little bananas. Tell us what's been happening here.
More than a little. it is literally bananas. Yeah, so as you mentioned, you know, the town and the state have sort of worked together in recent years to really fix up that intersection at, you know, Route 39 and 28, which has sort of been a hotbed for traffic issues for a long time. And they put in this rotary with a, you know, a nice, you know, weathered steel sculpture in the center. So it was substantially complete in April, early May. And now, you know, in recent weeks, if you've passed by the rotor, you might have noticed there's banana peels. And in some cases, you know, whole bananas just sort of littering the concrete base beneath the structure right in the center of the rotary. And, you know, it's kind of been met with, you know, a lot of amusement by people. Some people are a little upset at the seeming kind of stupidity of just littering peels in a public way, but it's sort of inspired, if nothing else, a lot of curiosity as to, you know, what's going on and why.
So somebody or some people are throwing banana peels onto the rotary there. When you say it's inspired, what kind of conversation is happening around this? Do we have any idea why? What are some of the ideas that people have about why this is happening?
Yeah, there's no telling why it's happening or who's doing it. You know, we talked to police. They were unaware, but they're keeping a closer eye on it. It's one of those things that unless you catch somebody in the act doing it, it's hard to know, you know, what's going on. But, you know, as you mentioned online, on Facebook, you know, Orleans, like most towns, has their community Facebook page where they, you know, it's like a forum for just talking about what's going on in town. And, you know, certain people, you know, had their theories. The design of the rotary has been the subject of some criticism from some people. It's really not landscaped. It's kind of a big, you know, concrete mass. So it's been theorized that maybe this is sort of protest over the design of the rotary. But again, we don't have any way of knowing. But in a lot of the comments, a lot of people, I think, just I had some fun with it. You know, there were references to, well, Donkey Kong must be in town, or, you know, so they just throw the peels and split, you know. So, you know, people are just, it's really become fodder just for sort of conversation in town more than anything.
Well, that said, it is littering, right? And the town has to deal with it. They want to keep the rotary clean. And there's actually fines that could be associated with this.
Yeah, under Mass General Law, and they can be steep. You know, they started, I believe, $1,500 for a first offense for, you know, littering on a public way. In this case, second and subsequent offenses could be as much as $5,000. So we may not think much about littering, but, you know, the potential for serious financial penalties are certainly there if you are caught.
And your article points to one other precedent for this, which I didn't know about that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the plot thickens. It's the story, which that's when you think the story couldn't get crazier. Yeah, this is not an unheard of thing on the Cape. In Sandwich, there's a small rotary that has been sort of playfully described as the Fruit Loop, and they've been incurring the same problem for a number of years now. That was another thing that was discussed. Maybe this was sort of Fruit Loop 2.0 or Orleans, trying to sort of take some of the shine away from Sandwich. I don't know. But yeah, in Sandwich, there's a precedent for this kind of behavior, you know, amazingly enough.
Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Ryan, thank you for bringing us this mystery.
Okay, Steve, thanks.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. For 35 years, Provincetown has been served by year-round air service to Logan Airport. That is going to end this November. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent joins us with the story. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
Cape Air, which serves this route from Provincetown to Logan Airport, made the announcement recently saying that they're going to not have winter service. Tell us what they said.
The letter came on August 30th, and it said that we'll be stopping service on November 4th, and we won't resume again until the middle of May. So it's a little more than 6 months out of the year. And it has sort of really taken this community by surprise. A lot of people count on it for getting to doctor's appointments in Logan or just getting to connections in other cities. Cape Air lands right in Terminal C in Logan. You can jump right on a JetBlue flight. And it's a really big loss. It's about 2.5 hours to get to Logan by car, and there's no ferry service in the winter. So it's a big deal for a lot of people.
What are they saying about why they're discontinuing it?
Cape Air says that they've actually been asking for a change since for more than a year now, that they first raised this with the Airport Commission last summer, that the route hasn't been profitable in winter, which is not that unusual in Cape Cod for the summer to be very profitable and the winter to be a loss. That's a lot of businesses out here. But the arrangement of the airport has been we require year-round service. Because we require year-round service, no one can come in and poach your summer business, because the only way to operate out of this airport is to offer flights both in the profitable summer and the unprofitable winter. That has been the arrangement for 35 years. Cape Air has said, this isn't working for us. The profits are not being outweighed by the losses, and we need to make a change.
I didn't realize that they're actually contractually obligated to run a year-round service. I didn't know that the contract that they have with the airport there states that they are supposed to run year-round service. So if they stop, they're in breach of contract. Is that right?
That is right, and that is important. You know, we got the lease. We got the airport's published minimum standards. The Airport Commission has been talking about trying to loosen those standards and say maybe if it's only 3 days a week in the winter, would that make a difference? And kind of, I think the message from Cape Air has been, no, that doesn't help. We still have our fixed cost of staff. We still have our fixed cost of rent. And fewer flights in winter doesn't really solve the there's no money in winter problem. So some of the changes the Airport Commission offered, I think, didn't work out because they're saying we're losing so much money in winter that there are no terms other than perhaps some guaranteed revenue where the town will buy tickets if they're not selling. You know, you could give them to Outer Cape Health. You could give them to your a support group or helping our women, but short of a revenue guarantee, it's hard to see what solves the problem of there's no revenue in the winter.
But right now, Cape Air receives kind of a most favored status because it flies through the winter so that it pays much lower fees for the airport use that it has now. If it were to stop winter service, those fees would likely go up dramatically, but not so much that Cape Air would consider continue flying, I guess, through the winter.
It's a $100 landing fee on a Cessna based on weight. And yes, those landing fees were actually put in place to discourage summer charters from coming in and poaching business. They were actually put in place to benefit the arrangement in which you have to have both summer and winter service. And if Cape Air goes seasonal, the town manager has said they would be expected to pay them. It's north of $100,000 per season. Cape Air has said, I didn't manage to get this into the story, that they would just pass those costs on to the passengers. And that is going to remain a point of contention. But yes, if they break the existing lease, which says that they have to abide by these minimum standards, they've been asking for a new lease for years. They're going to have to accelerate the process of getting a new lease. And a lot of things are on the table on what that would look like.
What did you hear from Cape Air? You reached out to them specifically about this.
They, you know, at first it was a very anodyne statement. And then, you know, after some detailed questions, they did have some detailed responses. And some of them were, we've been asking for a new lease since 2017. And we sent over our comments on the town's proposed lease last December. And we haven't heard anything back for 9 months. Those, I think, were, you know, relevant facts that we made sure to include in the story, that they've been asking for changes and the process has been going slowly, from their point of view, at least.
So there's, in some ways, they're forcing the process now. If they feel like they haven't gotten an appropriate response from the town in looking for changes in the lease.
I think that's true. It's also true that August 30th, you know, they're basically saying we're going to stop service 2 months from now. So for a town that has a certain kind of process for allocating money or making changes, it's not giving a lot of time to adapt. So if you'd said on May 30th, we're going to stop in November, you might be able to work something out by November. At this point, at this juncture, it is kind of not just forcing the issue, but forcing the issue in a certain direction, which is we're probably not going to be able to have service this winter.
It is Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. You can read all about it on the website. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Federal agents from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, what's called ICE, have been making arrests on Nantucket this week. Jason Grazia, Dave, Nantucket Current has the story and more. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
This is the agency that deals with immigration violations. What do we know about what or who they're targeting on the island?
Yeah, we started hearing about this earlier this week, that there were that ICE was on island, that they were going around in unmarked cars and making arrests, in different areas around the island. We had reached out to the ICE field office in Boston to sort of ask what the, you know, what who they were going after to arrest, what the charges were, you know, what sort of the thrust of the operation was. Have not heard from ICE at all about this. Nantucket Police Department did yesterday issue a statement and sort of outlined how they've cooperated with ICE on this and said that the agents were on island to serve administrative arrest warrants for immigration violations and that the arrest warrants were specifically for, quote, violent offenders. And they were assisting the agency by sort of helping them track down certain addresses and sort of lending their knowledge of the geographical areas of the town to the visiting ICE agents. So obviously this, you know, with Nantucket has a very large immigrant community, and the word that, you know, ICE was here, you know, spread very quickly. We talked to Esmeralda Martinez, who whose parents immigrated to the United States from El Salvador. She is the first Latina candidate to hold elected office on Nantucket. She's in her second term on the school committee. And she said this has been really frightening for a lot of people on Nantucket, not sort of knowing who was being targeted and what was happening. She said people are hiding in fear, and that it had caused a lot of panic for a lot of people. So covering that aspect of the story as well, and hoping to hear more from ICE about the people that have been arrested.
Let me ask you about another story. This is more of a human interest story. The future of a restaurant that's been operating on island since 1935 is in question now as its current location is slated to be redeveloped. This is the Downey Flake. Explain to people maybe who aren't even familiar with it why this is important to islanders.
Yeah, the Downey Flake has been around since 1935. It's been in different locations around the island. It used to be downtown. Now it's in the Mid-Island area. It's really a year-round establishment. It's sort of a throwback diner, famous for its donuts, great breakfast spot. And really, you know, the key being it's relatively affordable for Nantucket. So, you know, really a place that people love and value. And it is part of, it is an area that was sold over the last few years to a Boston-based developer that is going to redevelop the whole stretch of Sparks Avenue in the Mid-Island area and put up a new mixed-use development that's going to include housing, restaurants, bowling alley. But in preparation for that, they are demolishing everything that's there, including the location of the Downey Flake restaurant. So come mid-October, that is going to be closed. And the owners, Patty Kennedy and Ron Olden, they've run it for the last 11 years. Mm-hmm. And they're contemplating the future. They own the business and the name Downey Flake. The developer would like them to come back, and when the building is finished, to come back and move in there. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, debating whether to do that, maybe to find another location on the island while the building is under construction. So it's really up in the air right now. They hope that it will continue. The developer certainly hopes so, mm-hmm. but the future a little uncertain for this sort of staple of the island.
Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. Jason, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
After a year of contention, the head of the state's Cannabis Control Commission is now officially out of a job, and Governor Healey met with other New England governors and Canadian officials to talk about energy and climate change this week. CAI's Gilda Geist talked about these stories with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Katie.
Hey, good morning.
The chair of the Cannabis Control Commission, Shannon O'Brien, was fired this week for what Treasurer Deborah Goldberg is calling gross misconduct. Can you tell us, what does that alleged gross misconduct entail, and how has O'Brien responded to her firing?
So in her letter officially firing O'Brien, Deb Goldberg didn't go into detail on what that gross misconduct was specifically. We know that over the past year, when Shannon O'Brien has been on paid suspension from her post before this firing, that investigators were alleging that she had made some culturally and racially insensitive comments, and also that she'd mistreated the commission's former executive director, Sean Collins, a close Goldberg ally, including by inappropriately discussing his parental leave. So the specifics there, if there's more beyond that, are still a little out there, but we may find out more because it sounds like this is going to move into the court system. Shannon O'Brien plans to appeal her firing to the Supreme Judicial Court, the state's highest court, and that's really in keeping with what she's been saying for the past year. She maintains that she was brought in to fix dysfunction at the CCC, and it's the people who those efforts kind of hinged around who then subsequently raised concerns.
This week, Governor Maura Healey, along with other New England governors, met with Canadian officials to talk about how to work together to address climate change in the region. Can you tell us what came out of that meeting and what will this collaboration look like going forward?
So the group, the premiers from Eastern Canada and the governors from New England, are going to keep meeting and keep talking. They formed a couple of committees to focus on issues like offshore wind supply chain, hard to decarbonize sectors like transportation, and the climate-related impacts like food security, resilience, biodiversity. So they're hoping to really keep these lines alive. They say that the bonds they have, comparing them to family ties, are really what will help them tackle thorny problems like climate change in a way that's strategic, not just transactional, that they can work together for the benefit of the region.
Katie Lannon from the State House, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is CAI's Gilda Geist speaking with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. This is the Local News Roundup on CAI, and that's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We spoke with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Paul Benson at the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. And, of course, our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon, there speaking with CAI's Gilda Geist. Big thanks to Amy Vince for engineering the program. And thank you to everyone who pitched in with support during our short fund drive, which ended yesterday. We did come up short. If you didn't get a chance to help, there's an opportunity right now. Go over to the website That's all we got. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.